Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Anne McElvoy, and you're listening to The Economist Asks. And this week we ask, what makes Donald Trump's populism so potent? As the new president cuts a controversial swathe through his first days in office, populism in action is exciting his supporters, with clampdowns on immigration, a burst of quickfire executive orders, and fights with institutions from the judiciary to the State Department. But what lies behind the new populist surge? John Judis is author of The Populist Explosion. He spoke to our US editor, John Prideaux, who started by asking him what the difference was between right-wing populism and the left-wing kind.
Left-wing populism characterized American Populist Party, Huey Long, Bernie Sanders, Opposition Wall Street, Podemos in Spain, Syriza in Greece, tries to unite the lower and the middle of society against the top. It's a two-term. It's dyadic in that sense. It sees it's a conflict between the people and what Sanders, called the billionaire class. Right-wing populism, conservative populism, also sees a conflict between the people and the elite and has many of the same complaints as Trump did about a rigged economy, about corporations moving overseas and leaving workers in the lurch. But there's usually a third element, an other, be they African Americans, Muslims, Muslim terrorists, illegal immigrants, which the elite or establishment are seen as coddling, as favoring over the people. So that characterized, again, Trump, the Front National, the Danish People's Party, UKIP in Britain, the more right-wing populist parties. The thing I want to say, though, that to qualify that is that let's say the Front National, Marine Le Pen in France, their domestic program is way to the left of the leadership of the Democratic Party in the United States on, you know, capping credit card charges, universal health care, regardless of your income or location and so on. It's in many ways, the left-right distinctions don't in some way are defied. You know, there's all these complaints about Donald Trump not being a normal Republican. And indeed, he's not, because a normal Republican wouldn't be defending Social Security and Medicare and complaining about corporations moving to Mexico. So again, those are positions which, again, you'd find more in the Democratic Party of the left. So again, take my distinction between left-wing and right-wing populism, but understand that we are in a peculiar kind of time in both the United States and Western Europe where politics is in turmoil and the usual definitions of left and right center, are getting mixed up. And it's hard to characterize these populist parties because they are themselves signs that the ordinary politics is breaking up, that the prevailing consensus is under attack.
I wondered also, reading the book, whether one thing that's characteristic of populism, both on the left and on the right, is to deny that there are difficult trade-offs in politics. There's a kind of have your cake and eat it element to populism. And you write about Huey Long and his program for giving every American a family, a car and a house and a radio, the share our wealth societies. And it's hard not to read Donald Trump's stuff about Obamacare saying, everybody can have much better healthcare and it can be much cheaper, and think that this is also, kind of part of the same strand. And what then follows from that, I think, in populism is that there has to be some reason why this incredibly obvious thing isn't being done at the moment. And then you get into, the populism on the right. So you mentioned in the book, you get into scapegoating sometimes. Populism on the left, you get into kind of, bashing of greedy elites.
Right. I think you put it in maybe the most pejorative sense, and I'd put it in a more neutral way, which is that the populist parties, candidates, movements are usually based upon demands that the establishment or elite, which include both the leading parties, are unwilling to grant. The best example in America was Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All and free college tuition to public universities. Now, those are demands that you could not get through the present Congress in any conceivable set of circumstances that I could imagine. Yet they're not unreasonable. Canada, Western Europe, there are things that can be done. So, again, the defining characteristic isn't so much pie in the sky per se, but things that the elite won't grant. And so that's why they're popular. That's why they see this difference between people and the elite. Sometimes what happens to these parties is that they get into power and they find that they can't do it. I mean, the Greece, Syriza, we're not going to put up with these terms of austerity that the Troika has imposed upon us. But they get into power and they find they can't do it and they have to give in. And so in that sense, they cease to be populist. They become kind of another left-center party. We'll have to see what happens with Trump, because he's struggling right now between the kinds of, you know, we're gonna maintain health insurance for everybody, but it's going to be cheaper. On the one hand, and the Republican leadership, which wants to basically gut the whole program and create a program that has, you know, less access and will turn out to be more expensive. But, you know, the doctors and hospitals and insurance companies will make out like bandits. That's my pejorative version of that. But I'm just saying, yes, I think that there is this kind of conflict. And when a populist candidate happens to succeed and get into power, that's when you see this kind of, because they become, in effect, the establishment. And what are they going to do now? And these demands, you know, are they going to actually go through with them?
And in the book, you follow an economic explanation for the current wave of populism, which we, the kind of thing we like at The Economist. You talk about the after effects of the financial crisis. While the presidential election was on last year, while the campaign was on, there were a lot of people who were talking about Donald Trump's populism in cultural terms, particularly in terms of race. Tell me why you think it's right to kind of focus on the economics.
Look, I don't focus only on economics, but what I've been trying to combat is the view that it's all about what white supremacy or misogyny or, you know, some kind of secret alliance with Putin, which I think, again, misstates what Trump is about and what populism is about. In the United States, we've had this kind of discontent. You know, in Britain, you call them the left behinds. We've had this group within the middle and working class that have felt besieged, both from the top and the bottom. At times, it's manifested itself in a racial politics, George Wallace in the 1960s. At times, in a more cultural religious, the religious right. What distinguishes this present period of populist upsurge in America is that it was prompted by the Great Recession, and that's a major theme. It's not the only theme. It's not the only consideration. If you listen to Trump's speeches, and I, you know, went around with him, and you could just even take his current press conference. What did he lead off with in his press conference? Ford, Carrier, all these companies I've stopped them from moving their plants to Mexico. He didn't lead off with, you know, Mexicans are rapists or, you know, whites are better. In fact, I never heard him say anything like some of the things that are attributed to him in terms of white nationalism. I'm not trying to say that his proposals make sense to me or that they're good or bad, but that the upsurge of which Sanders and Trump were a part comes in the wake of the Great Recession. And that's a major theme. And that you can't say that, in fact, it had no, you know, economic anxiety was irrelevant. I just to, one other thing about it. If you look at Trump's vote in the 2016 election and where he did well and where the election is won, and then if you look at a map of where the United States lost manufacturing jobs from 2000 to 2016, there is this remarkable match. The biggest states for one of them, well, you'd guess Michigan, but the second biggest state was North Carolina. Again, a state Trump wasn't supposed to win and that he won. The furniture industry, a lot of it moved to Mexico. So, again, I think that that's I wasn't saying that that's the only issue and that there aren't all these other elements, the nativism, what have you, but that you can't have to, that you have to understand that that's a big part of it.
So one of the things you write about in the book is the way in which populism in politics often begins sort of on the fringes, you know, taking positions on policies that seem, you know, way out of the mainstream and completely impractical and sort of dismissed by many people who are currently in power. And then sometimes what happens is that gradually they get, you know, co-opted. A populist, you know, becomes a nominee of a party. William Jennings Bryan used the example in the book of the progressive income tax, which was, you know, thought as a kind of out there idea, and then, you know, becomes kind of, you know, mainstream in America in the middle of the 20th century. Let's throw this forward a little bit. We have a Republican president who has some populist elements to his platform, who's won the nomination of his party. Have we actually already seen the kind of incorporation of populism into the party? Was that what the election of Trump was? Or are there sort of things now on both right and left in American politics that are sort of currently a bit fringy that you think will be kind of mainstream by the middle of next decade, say?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say because we have the two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, are very close in terms of their support. And the Democrats have different kind, the populist elements in the Democrats are a little different from those in the Republicans. Let's just talk about Trump for a minute and what's unusual about him and the question of whether it's going to go forward. I think the thing to look at in terms of him is not so much populism, which again is political campaigning, but nationalism as the really the key underlying substantial element. And with him, it's not, I don't think it's put on. It goes back 20 or 30 years, you can find it. Military foreign policy, America has to worry about itself. Skepticism about entangling alliances, burden sharing with NATO. He put on in 1987, he had a full page ad in the New York Times about burden sharing in NATO. So this isn't any new stuff with him. The economic nationalism, getting jawboning companies not to move overseas and leave workers in the lurch. Immigration, I think, again, you know, he's not going to deport 12 million. I think that, again, was in order to appeal to the campaign. In fact, what he's now says he's doing is no different from what Obama did, which is to deport criminals, which, you know, makes a lot of sense. So, but still, I think he will be much more vigilant about illegal immigrants coming into the country. There will be some kind of a wall. The test for me with Trump and whether he can succeed politically is not so much the those parts as the part of him that is still a New York Democrat. What is he going to do about Obamacare? Is he going to leave, again, the 18 million people without insurance? Is he going to accept the congressional leadership's desire to privatize in some way our Social Security and Medicare system? You know, if he can do those, if he fights them on those things and succeeds, and if he actually comes up with some kind of a semblance of a health care replacement, he could have a successful presidency.
author John Judas talking to our US editor, John Prideaux there. That's all from The Economist Asks this week. From me, Anne McElvoy in London. Goodbye.